This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Stage 19 of the 2004 Tour de France is now underway. Today's time trial on the course which connects Besançon to Besançon was considered to be a stage which could determine the winner, but that will apparently not be the case, as it would take a major spill or miscue on the part of Lance Armstrong to prevent him from winning a record sixth consecutive Tour de France. Joining me now from Paris is Bicycling Magazine Editor-in-Chief Steve Madden. Steve, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
After yesterday's Stage 18, from Annemasse to Lonlay-Saunier, Lance Armstrong enjoyed a 4-minute, 9-second lead over Ivan Basso. What, if anything, can Armstrong's Italian opponent do today to give him any shot at victory?
He pretty much has to pray for rain and flats and strong winds and for Lance to eat the wrong kind of food for dinner on Friday night.
Yesterday, there were rumors that this would be Lance Armstrong's final Tour de France. Would Lance's absence from the Tour de France be a good thing for the race? I'm sure it would be considered a good thing by about 10 guys finishing behind him this year.
Well, it depends on your perspective. I think if you're the Tour de France organizers and you're interested in keeping your product in front of the American market, the Tour de France would benefit from having Lance race next year. If you are a European aficionado, you're probably glad to see the guy going off and trying his hand at something else.
Who wins next year if Lance does, in fact, decide to pass up the Tour?
That's hard to say. I have to think that a guy like Jan Ulrich has gone to sleep every night in July for the last 5 years, wondering what his life would be like if Lance Armstrong had decided to stick with triathlon instead of cycling. I would like his chances, but he gets stronger as the race goes on, and I'm not sure that he would be able to come back next year in the shape that he would need to. And some of the other guys, even Mayo, Tyler Hamilton, who looked good for this year, just either had injuries or just kind of didn't show up for the race.
It's interesting that you mention Tyler Hamilton. As you say, he was the favorite, according to some people, before this year's race. Must be a terrible disappointment for him that injuries have done him in really 2 years in a row, although he, you know, persevered with a broken collarbone last year.
Yeah, you have to love Tyler. I mean, he's just he's an extremely tough, dedicated rider and just has never seemed to have, you know, anytime he gets a break, it's in his collarbone or something like that. And he suffered a fall early in the race on the flat part up in the northwest part of France. Didn't look at the time to be that bad a fall, but it hurt his back, and he just could never get comfortable on the bike, and he couldn't really stand up to pedal up the Pyrenees, and he had to drop out of the race at that point. It's kind of heartbreaking, really.
Does Lance look relaxed at the end of these incredible stages?
It's absolutely astonishing. He looked tired on Thursday, at the end of Thursday's stage. He looked, in the press conference, he looked a little wiped out, but I watched the time trial up Alpe d'Huez from the 150-meter mark near the finish line. And the guy went by, and, you know, it looked like he was clearly working. He was in his biggest gears and pumping as hard as he could. But for, you know, an amateur cyclist like me who climbed the mountain on Tuesday and was at death's doorstep by the time he got to the top, to see Armstrong looking almost, I don't want to say he wasn't working, but he looked almost fresh as a daisy. It was it put the whole thing in a completely different perspective for me.
Steve, it is perhaps not premature at this point to ask you where you put Lance Armstrong on the all-time list of Tour de France winners.
Well, you have to put him at the top. I mean, you know, particularly if nothing goes wrong in the next couple of days, you have to say he's the greatest Tour de France champion ever. You can't necessarily say that he's the greatest cyclist ever because Eddy Merckx won all kinds of races. He had pretty much a .333 batting average. He won one out of every three races he entered, no matter what kind of race it was. But when it comes to the Tour, if Lance wins, it's indisputable. He's the greatest Tour rider ever.
Steve Madden is editor-in-chief of Bicycling Magazine. He joined me on the line from Paris. Steve, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back. This month's Olympic trials in swimming, gymnastics, and track and field determined who would sport the red, white, and blue in Athens next month and who would watch taped primetime coverage on TV. But those who won't compete for bronze, silver, and gold in the Summer Games still have the green to think about. From Sacramento, Ben Trefney reports.
At the Olympic track and field trials last weekend, a fresh-faced girl in a bright white uniform took her place among America's top quarter milers before more than 20,000 fans in Sacramento and a television audience of millions.
And this time we get a start in the women's 400 final. And Sonia Richards looks to go out early, and she does.
19-year-old Sonia Richards, who just finished her sophomore year at the University of Texas, set an American junior record for the 400 meters at 49.89 seconds. Richards qualified for the Olympics by finishing second in the race, but she had already secured a lucrative Nike endorsement contract by turning pro just before the trials.
At first it wasn't an issue. I was definitely going to stay in school for 4 years, and we just kept getting all these questions and people telling us, you know, it was going to be a good idea, and I think it was just the best decision for me, especially being an Olympic year when there's a lot going on and, you know, a good time to come out.
Track and field athletes particularly, or any Olympic athlete, realizes that this is their one chance.
Sports marketing expert Bob Dorfman heads the creative department at Pickett Advertising in San Francisco.
All eyes are on them, and all eyes are going to be off them as soon as the Olympics are over. So they've got to go for the gusto and do whatever they can if they're interested in getting those endorsement dollars.
It's been nearly two decades since the International Association of Athletics Federations allowed paid sponsorships for track and field competitors. But between endorsements and prize money, only about 50 U.S. track and field athletes make more than $100,000 a year. USA Track and Field CEO Craig Masbach.
There's a huge gap between the best athlete in a high-profile event and a third or fourth-ranked athlete in a very low-profile event. That gap is huge, literally, you know, $5 million on one end and $5,000 on the other end.
The top U.S. earner is the darling of the Sydney Olympics, 29-year-old Marion Jones. According to the Track Profile News Service, Jones' Nike deal is worth $3 million a year. She also commands up to $100,000 just to show up at a major meet. Masbach says that money affords a leg up on the competition.
There's no question that athletes with greater resources are able to use those greater resources to assist them, whether it means massage therapy or the comfort in which they travel to events and then what kind of hotels they stay in.
But the temptation of fast money can also derail promising careers. Ronaldo Nehemiah held the world record in the 110-meter hurdles from 1979 to 1989 and now represents some of today's top youngsters, including Sonia Richards. But Nehemiah advises most young athletes to stay in school.
A lot of times they sign with an agent because they've been told a lot by an agent, so therefore they're no longer eligible. And then when the dollars and cents that they were told they would receive aren't there, stuck between a rock and a hard place, and it's a bad decision.
Nehemiah says the pressure can lead some athletes to use performance-enhancing drugs.
They see winning breeds notoriety, winning brings more value to you, therefore winning obviously will bring more financial gains for you. So, I mean, greed is the root of all evil, and that's why they do it. All of them do it. You know, they're trying to make money, more money than they normally would make.
That may include 29-year-old sprinter Tim Montgomery, whose career languished until 2000 when he reportedly began taking steroids and human growth hormones. Within 2 years, he had set a world record in the 100 meters. Now, he faces a lifetime ban for doping along with three other sprinters, including 33-year-old Christy Gaines. Gaines, a Stanford grad and former Olympian, blames track's problems on the lack of guaranteed money and the need to hustle endorsements.
We don't get treated like, you know, NBA, NFL, or Major League Baseball, so it's still amateur. You know, even though we make money and there are a couple of millionaires in track and field, we're not a professional sport. We don't have a union. We don't have anybody to represent us as a body, so we're not professionals yet.
But 35-year-old distance runner Marla Runyon sees things differently. 5 years ago, after completing a master's degree in special education, she qualified for her first world championships while earning about $800 a month as a YMCA desk clerk and without the benefit of a sponsor.
For my spikes, I would order from a catalog where you could return the spikes after 30 days. And so I was going through this process of buying a pair, putting on a credit card, wearing it for 30 days and returning it and getting another pair. You know, I was doing everything I could.
Now, Nike provides the two-time Olympian with shoes and a salary. But Runyon worries that athletes who land big contracts may lack perspective.
I think when you struggle, it really teaches you to appreciate the reward at the end of the struggle. And so when you start looking at a 17 or 18 year old and say, here's a six figure, I mean, I can't even imagine it.
Allison Felix and Connie Moore and Ingram Miller on the outside. And down through the straightaway with Tori.
18 year old sprinter Allison Felix recently completed her freshman year at USC. When she was only 17, she signed a reported 6-year contract with Adidas for $1 million. She's also the first track and field athlete to jump straight from the preps to the pros. Felix proved she was worth the endorsement money in the 200-meter sprint last weekend at the Olympic trials.
Felix wins it. Felix with the win. Tori Edwards second.
I want Allison Felix and Sonia Richards and Alan Webb to reach their potential, whatever that means.
Again, Craig Masbach.
If they and the people that advise them, including their coaches, think that leaving early from college and focusing on a professional career earlier will ultimately help them, then I respect that judgment.
In lane one, this year's world indoor champion.
At the women's 100-meter race at the Olympic trials, Christy Gaines failed to make the finals and later withdrew from competition. Marion Jones finished fifth. But 20-year-old University of Miami sprinter Lauren Williams qualified for her first Olympics. With 1 year of college eligibility remaining, Williams said she might turn pro if the price were right.
Now, millions of dollars, that's a different story. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, I might even go back to school, but millions of dollars, hey, I can talk about that.
The night after her July 11th press conference, Williams signed with agent Ray Flynn, who said he would immediately start fielding endorsement offers. For Only a Game, I'm Ben Trefney in Sacramento.
In lane four, the 2003 world champion. She was the fastest qualifier.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. In one of minor league baseball's smelliest promotions, the other night the Brevard County, Florida Manatees were offering a 1995 Geo Metro to whoever sat in the car the longest. Will Campbell had been in the Metro with two other Manatees fans for 3 days when he learned that he was the lucky winner of another Manatees promotion, a certificate entitling him to free cremation. After weighing his options as carefully as somebody who's been in a car for 3 days can do, Mr. Campbell stepped out of the Geo Metro, thus relinquishing his chance to win it, and accepted the free cremation. "I'm looking forward to finally sleeping horizontally," he said.
"Will your ashes float like some foreign boat, or will they sink absorbed forever? Will the Atlantic coast have its final boast? Nothing else."
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the return of Joe McGinnis to talk about his new book, The Big Horse. But first, Shaq Diesel motored into his new hometown on Tuesday, 6 days after he was traded from the Los Angeles Lakers to the Miami Heat. Here to gauge the impact of the Millennium Goliath on the Magic City, the Sunshine State, and the balance of the NBA is Miami Herald columnist Dan Le Batard. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm still breathless. I'm still hyperventilating.
I was counting on that. Absolutely. One can't help but compare Shaq's arrival in Miami to Babe Ruth's transfer to New York in 1920, or is this an apt comparison?
Well, I don't know. It was a long time before my time. I think that sports are bigger now than they were then. As big as the national pastime was and as big as Babe Ruth was in America, I think that you've seen a proliferation of sports across all mediums, across all generations, and I believe that Shaquille O'Neal is literally and mythically the biggest star in sports right now. So, I mean, I don't know. I can't compare it, but I suspect that at Babe Ruth's arrival, there weren't that many TV cameras, there weren't that many TV helicopters, there weren't that many airplanes flying overhead with signs trumpeting his arrival.
The Yankees, of course, won their first championship in 1923, 3 years after they acquired the Babe services. Will it take till 2007 for Miami to earn the Larry O'Brien Trophy, or will it be next season?
Well, well, it can't take till 2007 because Shaquille O'Neal won't be the player at 37 that he is today. I think that this is the best chance for Miami to have a championship because I think you're getting an agitated, invigorated, motivated Shaquille O'Neal, which is the best kind of Shaquille O'Neal. He's going to be in insane shape. I think you are going to see a different Shaquille O'Neal than you have ever seen because now he's got the wisdom accrued of team basketball. He's a much smarter player than he's ever been, and he's going to be motivated and agitated. And I just would not want to be, not even at 6'9", 300 pounds, if I were that, I would not want to be the man in the way of that.
There is, of course, a lovely possibility of irony that the Lakers could supplant the Boston Red Sox as perennial sad sack losers, I guess.
Well, I think it's going to take a while. I mean, the Lakers have won championships within the last couple of years. The Boston Red Sox haven't done so in 8 decades. So I think it's going to be a while. But you don't trade this man in his prime, and I guess that's what makes it analogous because you'll rue the day that you traded this man. I think Kobe Bryant is about to learn to his bitter dismay that he is not Michael Jordan, that Michael Jordan was able to do the things that he was able to do, even though he had Bill Wennington at center. Shaquille O'Neal makes the game much easier, props up has-beens because they get to shoot open jumpers. They're shooting in an empty gym, and Kobe Bryant was among the benefactors of that. He's a 350-pound black hole that just sort of sucks everything in the galaxy toward him during a basketball game.
Overstatement is just achieving new boundaries.
I don't know what you're talking about. This is not hyperbole. It's a matter of gravitational pull. It's a matter of physics and fact.
To acquire Shaq, Miami gave up Lamar Odom, Caron Butler, and Brian Grant, frontline players who helped the Heat make the second round of the playoffs this year. Has the team taken a couple of steps back, at least in the short run, before Shaq can eventually take it forward?
Do any of them have a gravitational pull that sucks things in the galaxy toward them?
We're back to the gravitational pull.
What are you talking about? Did they take a step back? No, they took a step forward with a size 22 sneaker. Those three guys, look, they're nice players, okay? But there's one player like Shaquille O'Neal in the last couple of decades. There are a lot of players like the guys that they just traded. And, you know, Lamar Odom is a young talent. He's unguardable, and he's got a future. But we have to remember, and I know there's a myopia in Miami because they fell in love with the scrappy underdog last year, but they need to remember that team was 42-40. That team wouldn't have made the playoffs in the Western Conference. That team didn't win a single game on the road against a winning team. They were an underdog. They're not that anymore. They come with expectations because Shaquille O'Neal, no matter what the pieces are around him, every year in the league, Shaquille O'Neal advances at least as far as the Miami Heat advanced last year.
Well, it sounds as if Florida fans are having a great time right now. What happens when their team loses game number one in the NBA regular season?
Oh, we set fire to the arena. Does that seem like an overreaction to you?
This whole thing seems to be, well, you deny hyperbole, so we won't get into that again.
No, he's got to win. I mean, that's what he's bringing. He brings expectations. He brings hope. And, Sammy Sosa was just booed in Chicago. Sammy Sosa was just booed after going 1-for-9. I mean, when they're not used to having expectations in Chicago. They had expectations this year. And so when expectations are disappointed, the outrage is going to be all the greater, especially sports fans who are visceral and passionate and, you know, just insane half the time. So, yeah, he's got to win. None of this means anything if he doesn't win. But what we're celebrating and what's getting the parade and the confetti and the red carpet is the hope that he brings.
With the addition of Shaquille O'Neal, the Heat is, of course, one of the favorites in the East. Now, will the Western Conference teams tremble at the splendidly ironic prospect of becoming Shaq fodder in the finals?
They tremble before Shaq. They did tremble before Shaq, and they're happy to have Shaq out of their conference because all of a sudden things have equaled out. Now, I suspect they'd be a lot happier if Tim Duncan and Kevin Garnett went to the East, too, but that's probably not going to happen. But Garnett and Duncan probably also happy to have Shaq out of conference. The problem becomes now this Eastern Conference is just ill-equipped to handle a man this size. The largest centers in the Eastern Conference are men that Shaquille O'Neal hangs from his rearview mirror in his, in his Escalade.
By the way, the other phone light is blinking. I understand we have Stephen Hawking on line 2, so we're going to check this gravitational pull stuff as soon
He'll
as I
tell
get.
Tell you, he will. tell you. Hawking will tell you exactly. He knows. He's a genius. The man knows, and he could tell you after watching L.A. Laker games. Let me ask you a question. How do you get that kind of star power at Laker games that close to courtside unless gravitational pull is involved?
Dan Le Batard is a columnist for the Miami Herald, and he joins us from time to time here on Only a Game. Thank you, Dan.
It's not only a game. It's more than that. It's about physics. It's about the galaxy.
On Thursday afternoon, several players on the Barrage, Philadelphia's Major League Lacrosse team in the four-year-old professional outdoor league, are getting loose for their game against the Cannons at Nickerson Field in Boston. I pull aside two of them, midfielder Matt Strebel and attackman Ryan Boyle, and confront them with one of the league's marketing strategies. In fact, I read to them the paragraph on the MLL website that says that the league's players come from excellent schools and that they are good-looking. Ryan Boyle is first to respond to this promotional contention.
Well, I forgot the shade today, so that might not be the case.
It's a good thing it's radio, right?
Well, yeah. So you don't worry about false advertising.
They don't know how good-looking we are.
I don't know. I think we're pretty good-looking guys. Yeah. We have our bad days, but I think, on the whole, we're a fun bunch.
They better be a fun bunch, or at least they'd better be in this particular bunch for the fun of it. 4 years on, some of the players are making as little as $7,000 for risking bruised hands, broken legs, and cracked heads on the lacrosse field. Nearly all of them have full-time jobs from which they steal time for the game. Since Matt Strebel and Ryan Boyle are both graduates of Princeton, which features, among other things, a very high tuition, I wondered if their parents were dismayed at their career choice, lacrosse at the minimum wage. Again, Ryan jumped in first.
Well, maybe him, because he's been out for like 3 years now. But I just graduated in May, so they understand that I'm just taking a little time off and just hanging out for like one more summer. But
I hope you guys play this again in 3 years, and Ryan's still playing in the league and trying to find a real job.
In fact, Strebel and Boyle and the rest of the players who fill the MLL rosters in Boston, Long Island, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Rochester, and New Jersey are already getting career training, at least if they aspire to careers in marketing or public relations. In this league, Ryan Boyle says, player responsibility to ensure customer satisfaction remains considerable even after the game's end.
It's huge. I mean, we have home games and afterwards with a session where we go and autograph and interact with the fans, and you hear some of the parents just say that part of this league is more rewarding than the NFL, the fact that you can get so close to some of the people that are on the field and go down and talk to them and get their signatures without any problem. I think that's what a huge appeal is to some of the fans, and I think that's where we come in. That's our responsibility to make that connection with the fan and be open with them, even if it's for like a brief amount of time after the game.
If that characteristic of Major League Lacrosse reminds you of another pro sports organization, perhaps you were a fan of the WUSA, the Women's Pro Soccer League that suspended operations after its third season last summer. Like the lacrosse players, the soccer players mingled with fans, particularly young fans, after each game. I pointed that similarity out to Boston Cannons coach Scott Hiller and asked if the disappearance of the Boston Breakers, who used to play on the very field the Cannons now occupy, sent chills up the spines of the lacrosse league's administrators, coaches, and players.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I think all guys realize that, and they know you don't get too many chances at this. So if they weren't cautious already, the yellow light goes up, and they're definitely cutting every penny and cutting every cost where they can going forward. I know that.
By day, Scott Hiller is an attorney. His players are insurance salesmen, real estate developers, graduate students, and coaches. At least one of them, defenseman Jed Raymond, has no illusions about supporting himself as a lacrosse player anytime soon.
Right. At this point, it is what it is. It's a league in its infancy. And for us to be a part of it really is an honor, because every league had its start, the NHL, the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball. There was always a point in their history where those guys were making $10-$20 a game. So in that light, there's no delusion on our part that, in the next 5 years we're all going to be making millions of dollars. But what it does is that the league is sympathetic to that. They recognize our commitment level is finite. We can practice once, maybe twice a week, one game closer to the weekends. And everyone loves the sport so much that they're willing to make those sacrifices, hopefully.
Historically, most people who love lacrosse have lived in one of a fairly small number of places. Baltimore, for example, upstate New York, Long Island. Major League Lacrosse is trying to change that. The MLL plan includes two bursts of expansion over the next 4 years, during which the league will grow to 12 teams, four of them out west. David Gross, who took over as the Lacrosse League's commissioner just this week, will preside over the expansion. He says he's well aware of the challenges Major League Lacrosse will face.
Well, it's absolutely a very crowded landscape that we're competing in, and it's not just in sports. We're doing family entertainment, so we're competing against all sorts of things like movies and vacations, etc. But what makes lacrosse so special, it is such a fast-paced game. The skill level, how quickly that ball moves, how hard the guys battle, and the high scoring makes it appealing to all fans. In our 4 years of existence, I've had only one fan say that they didn't enjoy their game. And that person's reason was there was too much action. If that's somebody's complaint, we'll take that as a ringing endorsement for the league.
There was no lack of action on Thursday night at Nickerson Field. The Philadelphia Barrage and the Boston Cannons combined to score 49 points. In the second quarter, the Boston keeper allowed seven straight goals without making a save. The game also lent credence to the commissioner's claim that, like the National Football League, Major League Lacrosse is characterized by parity. Before Thursday night's game, the victorious Barrage had won only three games while losing five. The Cannons, who've already clinched a playoff spot, had been 7-1. In Major League Lacrosse action tonight, New Jersey plays Rochester while Long Island visits Baltimore. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. Fears that Athens won't be ready in time for the Summer Olympics and that security may be insufficient once the Games begin have dominated Olympic headlines for months. But according to Greek-American and former soccer pro Greg Lallis, the result of July 4th's Euro 2004 finals should change all of that.
We are living in a dream, and we do not want to wake up. That's how Stelios Giannakopoulos, a midfielder for Greece's national soccer team, described his team's victory over the heavily favored Czech Republic in the semifinals of the Euro 2004 soccer tournament. Listen to it again. We are living in a dream and we do not want to wake up. Have you ever heard a better description of joy? And that was before the Greeks went on to defeat Portugal 1-0 in the finals, the greatest athletic accomplishment in Greece history. I'm half Greek on my father's side. The other half is New Jersey. I speak Greek, know my way around Athens, and make a mean moussaka from my 88-year-old grandmother's recipe. Greeks are an odd lot. We're equally prone to laughing and fighting. We make friends on the spot and hold grudges for centuries. And we always seem to turn mundane things like building stadiums into topsy-turvy adventures. But the 2004 Greek soccer team overcame all of that. This team was disciplined, humble, and creative. No stars. It was a team, through and through, working for each other and for their country. A friend of mine, a Frenchman no less, congratulated me for the Greek team's lesson in modesty and reality. Greece ousted the defending champs, France, in the quarterfinals. For all the criticisms of Greece's Olympic preparations, one thing has been overlooked. This is the golden age of Greek athletics. It started quietly, 12 years ago in Barcelona, when Greece won two gold medals, the nation's first golds in non-boycotted games since 1960. I remember being in Athens when Vasiliki Patoulidou upset the favored American to win the 110-meter hurdles. It was summer, so the Greeks had their windows open and their TVs turned loud. When Patulidou broke the tape first, the entire neighborhood filled with shouts of joy. Since then, Greece has won another 8 golds and a European basketball championship. But those gold medal celebrations pale in comparison to what happened after Greece beat Portugal. The entire country partied for a week, because for all its schoolbook history, Greece is a small country. It isn't supposed to beat the Portugals of the soccer world, in much the same way that it isn't supposed to pull off grand events like the Olympics. But now, Greece is the Euro champion. And trust me, the Olympics are going to be fantastic. Not perfect, not without controversy, and certainly not punctual, but they will be full of joy. The gods have gone demented is how one Athens Daily described the Greek soccer team's moment. Maybe divine dementia is what we all need these days. A little joy, a little dreaming from which we don't want to wake up.
Greg Lallis is a freelance writer and former professional soccer player who lives in Brooklyn. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. I got to see a man about a big horse, or at least talk to him about it. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The question in Olympic news this week is how well the athletes will perform before lots of empty seats. Care to speculate on why sales have been so slow?
What's Greek for plenty of good seats still available? I'm telling you, my idea's looking better and better. You're going to have the Olympics in Greece, go back to the old way, perform naked.
I don't know what to say, but we'll move right along. Not surprisingly, there have been protests about security measures in Athens. Do the protesters have a case?
You know, we're seeing that a little bit ourselves here in Boston as the Democratic National Convention prepares to come to town. An awful lot of this is, I mean, it's hard to argue against this on the off chance that something really bad will happen and you'll look stupid. But I think there's an awful lot of we've always wanted to try out this neat new technology and let's give it a crack. I mean, the main port of Athens was sealed for 2 hours so the divers could install an underwater monitoring system, which is an electronic web of cameras, sensors, and other intelligence-gathering devices. Now, somebody had that in a closet somewhere.
Absolutely.
You know, Greece is spending $1.24 billion on Olympic security for an event that apparently a lot of people aren't going to come to.
Two newspapers reported this week that Marion Jones' ex-husband, former shot put star C.J. Hunter, told federal investigators that Jones used THG, human growth hormone, EPO, and insulin, among other things, during the Sydney Games 4 years ago. Jones, through her lawyer, claims Hunter is just motivated by revenge. I think these two can still patch things up.
No, I think this one is irretrievably broken. I mean, again, this is one of these things, and we saw this a little bit during the extended impeachment kabuki at the end of the 1990s. There are two stories going on here. Number one, drugs and athletes. And number two, this investigation is leaking, you'll pardon the expression, like a sieve. There's a lot of trial by media going on here. Marion Jones is absolutely right about that. That having been said, C.J. Hunter better be telling the truth because there's a serious penalty to be paid for lying to the feds.
As Lance Armstrong loses his arch opponents and nears the Arc de Triomphe, there is speculation that this will be his last Tour de France. If he does win his 6th consecutive tour, can we place him alongside Michael Jordan, Babe Ruth, Martina Navratilova as one of the greatest American athletes of all time?
Without question. Uh-huh. Because this, while it's funky and foreign and not something we ordinarily pay attention to, he's forced our attention to it over the last 3 or 4 years. To win this 6 times in a row is extraordinary. He's going to concentrate on other races, including the Giro in Italy and the Vuelta in Spain. I suspect he'll also be doing the Tour de Nike, the Tour de Gatorade, the Tour de Adidas, and perhaps even the Tour du American Express over the next
basic
4 or 5 years.
Tour de dollar sign.
Absolutely. He's going
about.
To be doing the Tour de Agent, yes.
ESPN reported yesterday that player representatives of the Montreal Expos were informed that a decision regarding their team's new home is imminent and that the team will move to the D.C. area or to Virginia. So there goes your Havana dream.
What's the line from Butch Cassidy? I got vision and the rest of the world's wearing bifocals. I mean, let's put another team in Washington so a bunch of suburbanites can ignore it when it's really bad.
We have entered the part of the baseball season wherein teams must decide whether they are contenders and then trade or not trade accordingly. Have you any predictions regarding which general managers will do what and when?
No, I think that, you know, obviously the only real saga is Randy Johnson. Will he go to New York? Will he go to Boston? Apparently he doesn't want to come here. Will he go to Anaheim? A more interesting thing locally is whether the Red Sox can actually get the Philadelphia Phillies to take Derek Lowe off their hands for Kevin Millwood. And if they do so, there ought to be indictments flying the next day.
The Texas Rangers remain one of the more intriguing stories in the American League. Do you see any other team trying to follow the Rangers model by trading their best player in order to get better?
Well, this is now the second time the A-Rod factor has happened. I mean, Seattle did it and got better. Texas did it and got better. Buck Showalter is the manager of the year so far for what he's done with that team. I don't think their pitching will hold up, but I've been saying that since the beginning of May.
The NHL and the NHL Players Association met for 4 hours on Wednesday, during which the league presented 6 economic models for consideration.
Broke? Really broke? Holy cow, we're broke! No kidding, we're broke! And wearing a barrel on Madison Avenue.
That's only 5. But anyway, the union, rather than dismissing the proposals outright, instead requested more information. How many more informations can they...
8 more concepts! 9 more concepts! We need more concepts! No, I think that there is some indication that both sides are realizing that having a league that not a lot of people care about in the first place go out of business for a year runs the risk of people not noticing.
Assistant coaches for college basketball teams will soon have some new rules to break. Charlie, do you approve of the guidelines designed to, quote, take the celebrity out of the recruiting race?
We've talked at length sometime about the Dean Vernon Wormer factor in all of sports, namely, no fun of any kind! This does away with these schlocky things where, you know, a recruit will come to Kentucky and they'll walk him into Rupp Arena and all of a sudden the lights will go down and a spotlight will come up and some sort of generic movie hero music will start playing and they'll, at guard, number 5, and piped in applause and maybe Ashley Judd comes out wearing a Skippy t-shirt. And by God, what's wrong with all that?
It's America, after all. Rasheed Wallace will remain a Piston. Kobe will still sport the purple and gold, but Shaq is a Heat and Carlos Boozer a Jazz. Will we be looking at a totally different NBA next season?
Is a Heat? Is that
I'm mystified. A member of the Heat?
I am a Heat. You are a Heat.
A warm person? A calorie? I don't know.
A Kelvin. He's the big Kelvin. I mean, obviously the biggest change is Shaquille O'Neal. Going down, by the way, because I guarantee you it has been the goal of his basketball career to play with Marquette University graduate Dwayne Wade in Miami. But that's the biggest change. The other change being, of course, that the Los Angeles Lakers have slipped to a middle-of-the-pack Western Conference team. Rasheed Wallace, in a career not noted for smart moves, makes a smart move staying in Detroit. He's won his ring. It's a good place for him. It's a place where he seems to be willing to play without a lot of nonsense. And Carlos Boozer apparently played the Cleveland Cavaliers for suckers.
Finally, Charlie, here's a poignant warning against excessive celebration in baseball. On Monday, San Diego Padres minor leaguer Tag Bozaid suffered a season-ending injury when he least expected it.
I'm sorry. Stop. Serious injury to minor league career. He ruptured his patella tendon because he jumped on home plate too hard, celebrating a walk-off grand slam.
Charlie Pierce, who writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, rarely high-fives the microphone when we finished our conversation, but he did this time. He joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Ow, my wrist!
There's more information about this week's stories on our website, onlyagame.org, where you can also read the latest sports news, browse the Only a Game store, or get in touch with us. In his most recent book, The Big Horse, Joe McGinnis recounts the adventures and misadventures of Volpone, winner of the Breeders' Cup Classic 2 years ago, and P.G. Johnson, the Big Horse's trainer. Volpone was not a big horse on the order of Secretariat or Seabiscuit, but he was the best horse P.G. Johnson ever had. That was, in part, what drew Joe McGinnis to the story. Joe McGinnis joins me now from the studios of WAMC in Albany, New York. Welcome back to Only a Game, Joe.
Thank you very much, Bill.
According to the opening of The Big Horse, initially you were not welcomed particularly warmly by the man who was to become the center of this book.
Well, you have to be careful when you show up at any horse trainer's barn before sunrise, because that's when the serious work is being done. And they have 30, 35 horses in a very small area, and each horse has to do something specific on that given morning. And there's an awful lot of coming and going and saddling and unsaddling. And these are big, high-strung animals, and there's a certain amount of physical attentiveness that's required to avoid danger. And somebody blundering in from outside wanting to strike up conversation would not be very welcome anywhere. It was a question of learning how to wait until things calmed down. Once the sun rose and P.G. Johnson retired to his cubicle to sip a cup of coffee, then he was extremely affable.
Early in the book, you compare P.G. Johnson to an independent bookstore in the era of Borders and Barnes & Noble. Elaborate a little for me on that.
Well, the most horses P.G. has ever had at any one time is somewhere in the range of 35 to 40. He said he never wanted to train a horse he couldn't see. That puts him in stark contrast to some of these mega trainers like Wayne Lucas and Bob Baffert, Todd Pletcher, who have literally hundreds of horses at tracks stretched all across the country from east to west, and they have assistants who handle it, and mostly they're administrators. And PG just never wanted to get into that. He likes to get his own hands on that horse. He likes to look that horse in the eye every morning and develop a rapport, a feel for what the animal is trying to tell him. And you just can't do that if you're based at Saratoga and you've got 40 horses at Monmouth Park in New Jersey.
P.G. Johnson finally gets his big horse by purchasing a mare for $8,000 and then breeding her, hence producing Volpone. Did he feel right away that he had something special?
He thought that he had something special on paper. He had felt that the sire, Crypto Clearance, to whom he bred this mare prom night for a $20,000 fee, which was not a high fee as breeding fees go these days, he thought that that should produce something good. But you just don't know until the horse sets foot on the track. I spent some time over the weekend in the barn of a trainer named Patrick Biancon, who has a two-year-old named Scipion, a French-bred horse, who Patrick assures me will be next year's Triple Crown winner, that he will do what Smarty Jones didn't do. Mm-hmm. The horse certainly looks like he can fill the bill, but you know, as good as he looks in the morning workouts, as good as he looks standing in his stall, you just don't know until he's out there what kind of heart he has. So PG felt that this Volpone, he was big, he was tough, he looked like a competitor, but it took him a while to find his stride. And actually, the first race the horse ever won was a stakes race. He put him right in to see if he could sink or swim, and it turned out the horse could swim and run.
Joe, you spent a good deal of time at the track as a younger man yourself, and when you returned to it for this book, the fine stories of P.G. Johnson and others notwithstanding, racing was a diminished thing in terms of popularity. I found it depressing that people tended to show up in numbers only when bobblehead dolls were being given away. This must have depressed you as well to some extent.
Well, it was sort of depressing, right? They show up for the bobblehead doll, and what they'll do is they'll go through the turnstile 20 or 30 times, paying the $2 admission fee, because they'll get a bobblehead that they can then turn around and sell on eBay for $10 or $15. So they make a $6 or $7 profit every time they're called spinners. Every time they spin that turnstile, they're making money by carrying their bobbleheads back and then selling them on eBay, and they never even stay to watch the races. So I don't know that the attendance figures, they say, oh, Saratoga drew 1 million people last year. Well, how many actually came to watch the horses run? Certainly on the bobblehead giveaway days, there were an awful lot of people there that wouldn't be able to tell you how many legs a horse has.
Now, the story of an elderly trainer winning a big race with his own horse encouraged the Disney company to buy the rights to P.G. Johnson's story. Do you suppose that movie will ever be made?
Well, it's not in production yet, but a script is being written. That story, in true Disney fashion, will terminate basically where my story begins. They are going to close it out with the big horse winning the big race in PG's old hometown of Chicago. They're actually going to switch the racetrack to make it be at the track where he first met his wife, which it wasn't, but it's close enough.
Let reality get in the way when you're making a movie about a horse, right?
The Seabiscuit people certainly didn't. Disney's going to do it as a happy ending story. The ironic thing, I suppose, is that Volpone never won another race.
Right.
I had no idea that the horse was in a downward spiral that was going to culminate with him returning to the same race, the Breeders' Cup Classic, last fall, 2003, and instead of winning it, running dead last.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a story about a big horse who couldn't win a race. It's sort of an anti-Seabiscuit story.
Well, Volpone did have other distinctions, though, and if the movie is made, I'm sure that it will include the story about Volpone's role in exposing a failed scam that three guys tried to run at the Breeders' Cup where he did win. If Volpone hadn't won the sixth race in the pick six that day, I gather that the crooks might have gotten away with beating the gimmick bet for quite a lot of money.
Well, for quite a lot, but it was the fact that Volpone won at 43-1 that made the payoff so huge. And then it turned out that the only tickets on that particular combination had been purchased at the same small off-track betting outlet in rural New York State.
Mm-hmm.
And that attracted a little bit of attention. And it turned out that the tickets were bought by the former fraternity brother of a Drexel University student who happened to be working at the computer company that handled the online wagering.
Oops.
And they found a way to rig the system. They got the biggest payoff they could have imagined, but they also got unwanted attention eventually from the FBI, and they are serving prison time right now. So Volpone was called the FBI's Horse of the Year for 2002.
A great distinction, even if you never make it to the winner's circle again. Joe, I'm sure that you had hoped that by the time you had to finish the book, P.G. Johnson would have been healthy enough to return to the track and return to his horses. That wasn't the case when you finished the book. How is Mr. Johnson's health now?
It's not very good, Bill. He's still hoping to come to Saratoga, where he does hold the record for most consecutive years of having won a race. But he had throat cancer over the winter, 2 years after he survived prostate cancer. And as he was recovering slowly, having lost 35 or 40 pounds from the radiation treatments, in May, a terrible shock, his wife, who he'd been married to for 59 years and who was nursing him through this recovery period, dropped dead of a heart attack.
Oof.
And the death of Mary Kay Johnson, that's been an emotional blow that has really impeded PG's recovery. But he is a tough old man, and he is determined to get back up to Saratoga this year and to win another race. And he's talking with a smile on his face and a twinkle in his eye about his new 2-year-old called Portchester, who he says could be his next big horse. A columnist from the Albany Times Union just wrote a piece about him, asked him a question: will you ever think about retirement? Peachy's answer was, only at my funeral.
Joe McGinnis, the author of The Big Horse, published by Simon & Schuster, joined me from the studios of WAMC in Albany, New York. Joe, thank you very much. It was a great pleasure to speak with you again.
Thank you, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Thank you this week to Michael Stymack at member station WAMC in Albany, New York. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or web watch the webbed wonders of lacrosse. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Joe McGinnis, author of The Big Horse, and before that, the Italian soccer saga entitled The Miracle of Castel di Sangro.
I've got to stop writing about things that nobody in America cares about.
Well, yeah, time to get away from horse racing and soccer and start writing about celebrities, diets, and how to name your cat. Please don't tell me if you do it, Joe. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WB.